So thank you, everyone, for attending tonight. I know that there was some competition for your attention, a number of competing venues, including an inaugural film night by the government department. So, and I hear of various other events. So the fact that we have a great turnout for tonight, I think, speaks to the importance of the topic to hand, the Trump presidency, the incredibly great timing of the talk by Will Howell, given the inauguration this Friday. So let me make some introductions and turn you over to Will. Firstly, to announce, tonight's talk is part of the Government Department's public lecture series, so that's a bit of a nod to the Government Department, and thanks to people like Emma who have kindly organized the logistics for tonight. There is a designated hashtag for those Twitter fans out there, which is given up here, LSE Trump, not surprising, as the hashtag if you like to use it. So, on to the introduction. So I'm absolutely delighted to introduce Will Howell, who is the Sidney Stein Professor in American Politics at University of Chicago, the Harris School. His bio, in terms of his books and articles on American politics and specifically the American presidency, is astounding, and I won't even try to work my way through the many publications, except to mention just a few. He's got a book, his most recent book, 2016, and I will read the title verbatim, and then we can pause just a moment for reflection. The title is Relic, : How Our Constitution Undermines Effective Government, and Why We Need a More Powerful Presidency. Here comes the pause, right? Okay? I'm sure questions might arise on the content of that, and perhaps the argumentation. Notice part of the title there, which seems to be a theme to the title of a number of his books. A number of his books, I notice, have the title or have the word power in it, linked with presidency. So I think that there are various takes on that, constraining power, augmenting power, links between power of the U.S. presidency and Congress, power under wartime circumstances, and then one that interests me in particular is the persuasiveness of the presidency and how that is linked with his power. And it's been his. We have not had any women. So, without further ado, I know that there will be a number of questions. We have this room for an hour and a half until 8:30. Will, I think, is planning to speak for about 35-ish minutes. Then I might ask one or two questions myself, but I won't be one of those terribly annoying chairs who seems to take up so much time before allowing you some questions. So I might have one. And then we'll turn it over to what I think will probably be a lot of questions from the audience. So without further ado.
Thank you all for coming out. I'm already messing up. I need this water. I've been eating.
Move the keyboard.
You can move it down here if you want.
It's okay. It's all right there. I've eaten more potted meat and salted fish in my entire life than I have in the last few days. So I'm gonna. This is hot. This is fabulous. Glad to be here. So and to talk about this presidency that awaits and to offer a few reflections. I'm going to try to say a few things that are meant to be a conversation starter. I'm no oracle, right? I don't know what awaits. So if you came here to find out what awaits, I won't take offense if you want to leave, because I don't know exactly what awaits. I think that there are some interesting things that we need to pay attention to, and there's some big questions that the Trump presidency raises. But I don't have clear answers on exactly what he's going to do. I don't think anybody does. But there's a way in which what happened in November is there is connected to what happened here in June, and you all had your, well, you all had your fun with Brexit, right? And sort of paved the way, suggested there was underlying sentiment for, if not isolationism, then at least a kind of a turn inward. This is something, the development, Brexit as a development was something that Trump played up a lot in his own campaign. And we wanted to follow, right? And we followed, as Americans are wont to do, by doing you one better, right? By electing this man who is, and I say this as just basic facts about him. He is far and away the least experienced president we've ever had in the United States. He presents the most, the largest number, and in some ways the most profound ethical challenges in occupying this office. He's the least popular incoming president that we've had in the modern era, since we've done polling since FDR. His incoming approval ratings are, it depends on the poll, but he's roughly at about 40 percentage points. And Obama, who's leaving, is at 55%, which is remarkably high for the end of a second-term president. If you recall, Bush, when he left office after two terms, his approval ratings were in the low 30s. He's got the lowest approval rating. He failed to win the popular vote. And he's already dogged by all sorts of scandals, and we haven't even gotten started. And we're trying to make some sense about what this means in the United States for our domestic politics, and then what it means internationally for U.S. engagement around the globe, very much including U.S. relations with Britain. What to make of it? There are some connections, obviously, with Brexit, and the big storyline that came out of here that was played out stateside was about how the polls got it wrong here, right? We all thought that the polls suggested one thing and it came out the other way, and that's true, too, in the United States, where just about everybody was surprised. I think everybody was surprised. There were some people who willed themselves into believing that, in fact, Trump was going to win, but it wasn't because they had independent evidence that suggested that there was a reasonable case to be made that he was likely to win, but rather they had a set of ideological and partisan convictions that led them to believe that it could be so, right? And they were proven right. It could be so. It was right. And the polls there were wrong. The national, both the polls that were taking in the leading up to the election and then also the exit polls on election night, they were wildly off. So I spent election night on the decision desk at ABC News, and we were fed all these data, and we were supposed to make the calls. And, you know, at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening, it looked like a clear Clinton win. Exit polls are reliably biased in the Democratic direction, for reasons I can tell you about, if you're so inclined. But what happened this go-around is they were wildly biased in the Democratic direction when it comes to the exit polls. The national polls and the leading up to the election, it's interesting. The national polls had it about right, actually, in terms of the vote share. They had it about 48% that Trump was going to get, 47, 48%. That's what he got around the nation. But in the United States, as you know, we don't have one national election. We have 50 state elections for president because we have this thing called the Electoral College. And so when you want to add on to the layers of, uncertainty and irony in thinking back on this election, is that the thing, the institution that delivered in many ways the presidency to Trump was the Electoral College. So he loses the popular vote by 2 percentage points. But he wins the Electoral College because he's able to pick up the key 3 states that he's able to pick up, right, are Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And he barely wins those states. And this is a man, and it's hard to say these things without appearing partisan, and in many ways I am, but these are just the facts that are before us. He runs a campaign where a dominant theme was that our politics in the United States are broken. Right? It's rigged. Those are the words he kept going to again and again. It's rigged. It's rigged. It's rigged. How do we know that it's rigged? It's rigged because the electoral outcomes that we observe do not conform with the views of the people. And he gave lots of reasons to suggest that there was going to be a divergence between what the outcome was going to be and what the people really wanted or what the people really needed. There's some ambiguity about what the baseline category is, but it's a sense of what the people want, right? And what he had in mind is lots of vote fraud. And there's close to no evidence that there was vote fraud. That is, people coming in voting repeated times, right? People playing with the numbers and jacking up the Clinton's vote share. But what there quite explicitly is this lack of translation of the popular vote into the final outcome because of the Electoral College. And the Electoral College, right, is this institution that goes back to the founding that was meant to ensure, ostensibly, that there would be a check on the will of the public and the actual voting outcome because people would get it wrong. This is a theme I'm going to come back to shortly. So we don't vote directly for presidents. We vote for electors who then can act as a screen and provide corrections when necessary. And in that sense, the Electoral College, as an institution, distorts the popular will. But it does so, moreover, because the way, as strictly as an accounting scheme, the Electoral College works, is that it's state by state, and if you win in a state, you win all the electoral votes associated with that state. And small states are overrepresented, big states are underrepresented. What we had is that, right, Clinton won by huge margins in some big states, and Trump won by the narrowest of margins in some medium-sized states, and that led to then what? This institution we've had in the United States since the time of the founding, which rigs things. It rigs things, again, technically defined as it distorts what the popular preferences are as they're reflected in voting outcomes. It comes and resurrects the Trump presidency, an irony of ironies, after having run a campaign saying it's all rigged. But here we are. Oh, we've got him. And we were surprised because the polls were rigged, but we were surprised by more than that. There's more reason for the widespread belief that Clinton was going to win, because we knew going into the election that the polls can get it wrong because polls are increasingly unreliable. People are running around on cell phones and not answering when pollsters call, and it becomes increasingly difficult to get representative samples of populations. So we need to look elsewhere for information, and a place to look is the campaign itself. And in the summer, at least, Clinton had huge advantages on the ground game. She had an infrastructure built up around her, right, that was going to support her. She, on the endorsement front, she had, right, every major pop star that came out and endorsed a president supported Clinton, and Trump had... Well, he had Chachi, right? That was who he had. He had Chachi, who supported him. And there's not much else. There's not a deep bench of celebrities backing this man. And then if you look at newspapers, the 50 largest newspapers in the country, not one of them supported Trump. Not one of them. The largest newspaper in the country to endorse him was the Daily out of Las Vegas, has a circulation of about 130,000, and there are 56 newspapers that are larger, and every one of them, every single one of them came out and supported Clinton. If you look at the support within the party, like party elites, the Democratic Party got behind Clinton, and every major right? Rockstar in the Democratic Party came out and visibly supported Clinton. And not so with Trump. That's certainly true in the primaries, for sure true. And that carries over into the general election as well. And these things matter, right? These endorsements matter because there's a sense that we have, and again, I'm going to come back to this theme, that average citizens don't know how to make sense of politics, and so they look to elites for guidance on how to vote. And so to the extent that endorsements play a role in campaigns, and that campaigns have any kind of an outcome, have any kind of relevance for political outcomes, we ought to expect there to be a big advantage for Clinton. It ought to have translated. If ever a campaign should have mattered, this is one that should have mattered, because so many of the structural advantages weighed in favor of Clinton. That's true of endorsements. It's also true of money. She spends about twice as much as Clinton, as Trump. In the primaries, Trump is, Jeb Bush, who raises on the order of $120 million in the lead up to the campaign, and gets nowhere. And Trump, who spends almost nothing during the primary season of his own money, that is his own campaign's money, not his own money, the money spent through his own campaign, spends almost none, emerges as the nominee in a field that started of 17. And so against all odds on money, on campaign advertising, Clinton airs about three times as many ads as does Trump. All the advantages point towards Clinton. We've got Trump. Okay. What to do? How do we make sense of this? Because the first moment is one of, my God, right? This is, nobody expects this. How do we pivot? What do we do? And again, I want to resist. I think we should generally resist, and I certainly want to resist tonight the game that's of the form. What's the first thing that you think Trump's going to do? When do you think the Republicans are going to turn on Trump? What is the next tweet that he's going to hand down, right? And I want to resist that for a couple of reasons. One is because the shelf life of that kind of knowledge is incredibly short. It's just not knowledge that endures. And if ever there was a moment, it seems to me, that we need to pause and think a little bit more deeply about our politics and to try to make sense of the reckoning before us, this is that moment. And it feels like a cheap substitute. It's also a cheap substitute, one might say, I would certainly say, that had implications during the campaign, because so much of media coverage of campaigns has to do with what? It has to do with horse race stuff, right? Who's up in the polls? What position are they taking? What implications of that is that going to have, not for policy outcomes, not for the welfare or lack thereof of different subpopulations, but for who's likely to win? It's so much of the coverage is of this nature, which can displace the much more serious, harder conversations to be had about actual policy and the actual positions that the two candidates had. And I think we ought to, so I want to suggest that we should resist it. I also think that if ever it were difficult to make sense of what goes on in the mind of a man and what he's likely to do next, that certainly applies to Trump. We just don't know. I don't know. I mean, he may be playing some master game. It may be. But I've got no insight on the matter. So instead, what I'd like us to do is take a pause, right, and take a deep breath and say, all right, What should we look for moving forward? What's at stake with this presidency? What might it reveal about our politics that we thought we knew that in fact we didn't know? How might we see our political institutions anew in light of Trump assuming office? And I think that there are some opportunities for real learning about these much more enduring questions that we've been asking for a long time. And I want to train our attention on them. And so I wrote this short essay in leading up to tonight, and I want to draw upon that a little bit to say what these questions are. And I'm going to take them in a slightly different order from how they appear in the essay. And to start with the first one, which is the most straightforward one, which is, what does a Trump presidency portend for the two major parties? What is this going to mean for the Democrats and the Republican parties moving forward? And I think this is a big open question. The first party that's being called to account, obviously, is the Democratic Party. because the Democratic Party's on their heels, right? They ascend in 2008. And there's talk then about the possibility of a permanent Democratic majority and a sense in which all Republican views have been discredited and they're going to have to go out into the desert and make sense of what they truly believe in and come back decade hence when they might stand a chance at being competitive. But with this story of the 2016 election is not just a story about Trump. It's a story about the Republicans maintaining majorities in both the House and the Senate of Congress. And those are likely to endure through the midterm election in the 2 years hence. The third of the seats that are going to be opened up in the Senate are disproportionately seats held by Democrats. And so the Democrats are going to be playing defense in the next midterm election, certainly when it comes to the Senate. It's in the Senate where they stand a better chance of picking up seats because of gerrymandering. There aren't very many competitive seats in the House. And in the House, also, the Republicans have a slightly larger, percentage-wise, a slightly larger advantage. But it's not just at the federal level, right? We're about to see, in the next coming years, a Supreme Court that's clearly going to tilt right. We're going to see federal judgeships filled with Republicans. A majority of the state legislatures around the country have majorities of Republicans in them, and a majority of the governorships around the country are seats that are held by Republicans. This is, in many ways, a moment of Republican ascendancy, just 8 years after the United States saw fit to elect a man named Barack Hussein Obama. And so the Democrats have got to figure out what they're going to do, right? Okay, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a reckoning to be had on the right as well. And I think it plays out in two ways. The first way is simply that the demographics moving forward probably play to the Democrats' advantage. So the core support for Republicans around the United States consists of wealthy white people, white men especially, but white people, right? And as a percentage of the voting electorate, whites are constituting a smaller and smaller share of the electorate. They're in decline at the same time that African Americans, but particularly Hispanics, who vote disproportionately Democrat, are on the rise. So that African Americans vote consistently, 90% of them, somewhere between 90-93% vote Democrat. And it's lower among Hispanics, but it's still very high. It's well north of 70-75%. Among Hispanics. And so those are going to constitute a disproportionate share. That plays to the Democrats' advantage. But there also is a way in which Trump himself presents challenges to the party, which it'll be interesting to see how they make sense of it, right? So I think if we look back and we try to make sense of what happened in the primaries, part of the unease that the Republican establishment felt vis-a-vis Trump had to do with matters involving affect. The fact that, right, he lacked basic decorum, right? He would call people out and could be nasty and lacked experience. But it also was the case that the core tenets of his campaign, what to say, they challenge Republican orthodoxies, right? The party that in many ways trumpeted historically the importance of free and open trade is now being led by a man who's deeply skeptical about the benefits of free trade and thinks not just about the importance of protecting American industries, but doing so in ways that are sort of industry by industry. Right? It's not just what he thinks, it's the structure of his thinking that is remarkable in this space. And that's remarkable not just about whether or not it's good or bad policy, but right? This is not about a principled stance on the value of free trade that he wants to push against. It's that, no, we need to stand up for American workers, because anything that's good for American workers is good, right? And the way to protect American workers is through tariffs and by punishing countries that, or excuse me, punching companies that dare to think about setting up plants abroad, one at a time, and to intervene, and thereby intervene in the economy on a selective basis, which is another challenge to a set of Republican orthodoxies, which have to do with not just limited government, but a free and open marketplace, where increasingly, I think, we have a president who's going to see fit to intervene in a very selective basis on the basis of whether or not they think that companies are behaving in ways that are consistent with the interests of average American voters. So these are basic, fundamental challenges. And then there's Russia, right? And if ever there's a party that is within the United States that's skeptical of Russian claims to power, it's the Republican Party that has done so for a long time. And he's pushing back against that. So there are ways in which he's a Republican, but only in name. And it's not clear then what this is going to mean for a party that did go out into the desert in the 60s, right? And did try to articulate, they made major investments in think tanks and in journals and in trying to identify a principled stand about what it means to be conservative that now is being challenged by Trump. And I think, so I end that with question mark. I don't know. It may be that then they recover it. And they recover those principles and Trump is defeated. It may be that they're left shattered, but I think this is something we need to watch. One. Two, this is a little bit more abstract, but I think just as interesting and just as important. And it has to do with the status of virtue in American politics. What do I mean by that? Well, we're accustomed to thinking that virtue is not altogether necessary. We're not just accustomed to thinking it. This is what the founders themselves thought. The founders who were deeply committed to the importance of popular rule, for sure, right? The sense in which the doings of government ought to reflect the will of the people. But they also had an abiding skepticism in the capacity of average citizens to self-govern. They also were deeply skeptical about the average capacity of individuals to reason. And they worried deeply about the ways in which passion and ignorance and greed would grip a populace, right? And lead to what? Massive swings in the doings of government that would be ill-advised, right? They worried that in popular government we would find the ultimate indulgence of our basest instincts. And so they said, we got to introduce some checks. We got to ensure that, in fact, or increase the odds that the doings of government might better approximate the welfare of average citizens. How to do that? Well, one way to do that is to try to elevate the nature, that base nature of man. And they were just thinking about men at the time, right? This is about white-propertied men who were the only politically relevant group at the time. And they were skeptical of them, but one thing you might do is to say, well, what we want to do is invest in colleges, invest in these kinds of symposia, because through these, we will all become a little more enlightened, and our baser instincts will be suppressed, and just as our knowledge is enriched, and that then we might actually have a government that can effectively function. And they say no. No. The founders say no. We need to accept the nature of man as given. It is what it is, and it ain't pretty, right? We've got to accept it as given. Moreover, recognizing that some individuals might be more capable than others, what you might say is, well, we can build an electoral system that does a better job of ensuring that the enlightened ones, the selfless ones, the philosopher kings in our midst, might be the ones that assume power. And the founders, they don't altogether reject that notion, but they're skeptical that it's going to occur with any regular assurance. The Electoral College, again, is a gesture towards increasing the odds that we'll pick the best of the batch, right? For sure. But not good enough. So what they do, the founders do, is they built a system of government wherein power is separated. It's separated horizontally across three branches of government, three independent branches of government, if not co-equal, but independent branches of government, a judicial, a legislative, and an executive, just as it's separated vertically between a national, a state, and local governments. And we're going to set them upon each other. Right? We're going to set them upon each other with the idea, not that by putting you in the executive branch, once you assume that office, you're going to become enlightened, right, and become true and good in ways that right now, I can assure you, you are not. Right? No, it's that by taking one individual and all of his flaws and pitting him against another individual, against all his flaws, something that approximates the general welfare might occur. Through that interaction, wherein ambition is made to check ambition. Not that ambition is meant to translate into enlightenment. Not that vice becomes virtue, right? But that vice set upon vice might lead to something reasonable. That's the belief, right? Here's Madison. So I've got. How can we not invoke Madison here? In Federalist 51, the provision for defense must, in this as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. The danger of attack meaning the things that we have to worry about: the rise of tyranny, the passions of the mob, the ways in which popular government can get it terribly, terribly wrong. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. The interests of the man, which we're going to take as given, must be connected to the constitutional rights of the place where he, she sits. We need to see some connection between the two. It may be a reflection of human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? Right? Our system of government reflects human nature as it's currently constituted. And as it's currently constituted, again, ain't pretty. Right? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. Right? If we had angels who were occupying the seats of government, just do it. Tell us what to do. Off you go. Right? We won't have angels. We can't have angels. No, I retract that. It's not that we can't. We certainly can't expect to have it all the time. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and the next place oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, of no doubt, the primary control of the government, elections, the primary way in which we check them. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. Elections aren't going to be enough. We also need to separate power, divide power, have staggered elections, have this thing called an electoral college, and pit ambition against ambition, and then it's going to work, right? It's going to work, because my self-interest fighting up against your self-interest is going to lead to something that might, again, approximate our collective interests. That's the hope. And now I want to put a question mark by that, because I think that proposition is being tested with Trump, more so than with any other president we've had. Setting aside whether or not you're a liberal or conservative, whether or not you like him or not, just by reference to some undeniable facts, again, which has to do with his lack of experience and lack of temperament, that do we actually need some base level of virtue in order for things to work right? How much might that be, right? It's not to say that we will have we have plenty of experience with men who were not virtuous occupying the White House, for sure. But I don't think we've had one like Trump. And I think that this bet that was being made by the founders and that we've been making ever since is one that's going to be tested. And that I'm, for one, going to watch. The belief that it doesn't matter much who we put into office, As long as they do advance their interests as they see fit, the system will provide the necessary corrective. I don't know. Question. Which leads to my third and final question, and then we can open it up for some discussion. And the third and final one is shorter, but it's connected. It has to do with the extent to which the office does or does not discipline the man. So, in my own scholarship, in most scholarship that's done by people who study the presidency today and who have studied the presidency for the last couple of decades, what they tend to say is what we need to do is make sense of the office, because the office remakes the man. We've only had men, right? It remakes it so that even if you run on a promise to do narrow-minded things, that when you sit in that position of power and you look out at the vast national electorate that you're supposed to represent, you're going to be transformed, and your attention is going to be trained on things that are different from the things that they were trained on when you were a legislator and you were fixated on your district, or when you were a governor and you were fixated on your state. And that if you want to make sense of the decisions that presidents make, you would be better served to pay attention to the specific powers that they're given, the incentives that they have to do some things and not others, than you would to try to mine their biography to find that moment when some political psychologist suggests you experience failure and the lessons you draw from that failure, that first failure, right? That if we can, or try to make sense of Barack Obama's audacity and where it came from in his biography, right? And the fact that his mother was white, and why that might be relevant. If we could just make sense of that right? He's our first black president, but his mom is white. What might that mean for the time he spends occupying the office? Most scholarship today says, oh, we don't need to do that, right? That first, because we're not going to ever answer that question, and it's going to indulge some of our worst scholarly sensibilities, right? Run, let's pay attention to the design of an institution, but there's also an empirical component for it, because there's this belief that the institution will discipline the man. The institution will discipline the man. And I think we can put a question mark by that. Not that it isn't true, but the question to my mind is, how true is it? How true is it? How much will it discipline the man? Because the kinds of institutions during the primary season and the general elections that were meant to discipline our incoming president, he laid waste to. Right? The kind of institutions having to do with party structures, for instance, who are supposed to play a role in discerning who the nominee is going to be. The kind of institutions having to do with interest groups and their giving, or the role of, again, newspapers and their endorsements, that's supposed to winnow the field and inform an electorate and guide us towards he wins not just as a long shot because he came in with very little experience, but then he defies every convention that we have about how one runs a successful campaign. And so the question that people asked in the States over and over again is, well, now he's going to start acting presidential, right? He's going to start acting presidential when he gets the nomination, right? When he's on the debate stage, when he wins on election night, that then there's going to be this conversion. And I would suggest that conversion that many opponents of Trump are looking for, it hasn't happened. It clearly hasn't happened. And maybe it will when he assumes the office. And maybe the office and the enormity of it, the totality of that institution, right, which is not just the office and its powers, but this executive branch and all the departments and agencies and commissions that constitute it, and all the channels that he's going to have to work with, and the treaties that he's going to inherit that he's going to have to deal with. He doesn't get to remake the corpus of law anew. He doesn't get to remake his constitutional authority anew. He's going to have to deal with a set of endowments, not of his making, in order to advance his own agenda. And so there's reason to believe that, yes, that office will discipline this man, but the question that I would simply add is, how much? How much? And that proposition is going to be tested to a greater extent than we've seen with any president, certainly in the modern era. So those are the three questions that I am going to be watching. I don't have answers now, but I think they're things to pay attention to, right? What's to happen to the two major parties? What's the status of virtue in our politics? Do we have a system by design that can provide a corrective to personal failings? And lastly, will the office as it's constituted discipline the individual who occupies it? That's what I'll be watching for. But let me stop there and open it up for all of you to offer comments, questions, thoughts of your own.
All right. Thank you very much. That was great. I'm going to use my prerogative as chair just to ask one question, okay? I have another one, but I may or may not slip that in. We'll see, but I'll just ask one. So there's one glaring, dare I say, elephant in the room that you've not talked about, possibly as an institution in the U.S. and the role that it played, not only in the lead up to the election, but also going forward. And that is, if you want to call it, the institution of the media and the role that it played in the transformation of the media leading up to the election. So things like the 24/7 news cycle, the decline of the traditional media outlets, the lack of, and this I contrast it with the UK, the lack of a single source that is for the most part relied upon to provide the truth. And like it or not, for most people, the BBC is a respected news outlet for Brits. There's no equivalent for Americans, we might say PBS, but it's really not on stature of the BBC. So there's no single outlet that Americans go to for the truth. So that is one other aspect. The use of social media, effectively used by Trump. So all of that in the lead up to the election, the effect that it had, but then going forward, if you think about one role for the media is to ensure some degree of accountability, to ask the difficult questions. Traditionally, that's been the role for conventional media outlets. When you have Trump trashing CNN and saying it's a lousy news outlet, we're in uncharted territory in going forward in terms of the facility of news outlets to challenge the administration. So the question then is, what do you see as both looking backward on the election and going forward the role for the media?
Oh, there's so many parts to this. Yes. Okay, so let me offer a few thoughts. It's going to be a yes-no answer, right? There's some ways in which clearly the media played a hugely important role in this campaign. I would suggest the biggest effect that it had we observed in the primaries, not in the general election, because so much attention, media attention, was trained on Trump. So how does he overcome the fact he didn't have any money to spend? Right? Is that he's getting what is effectively free media attention all the time. The amount of media coverage to him at various points was higher than the rest of the competition combined. Right? And so that was something he was able to leverage to his advantage. And it's interesting, he was able to leverage that to his advantage in this highly fragmented media market. That everybody saw fit to be talking about this guy. And in a field of 16, where so much of the game is about not just what's said about you, but whether or not anything is said at all, that's a win for you. I think that's one thing we might point to. The social media too, I think, is a big one. We don't have clear estimates about the effect of his tweets on public opinion or on vote choice. We don't know. What we do know is a lot of people cover it, right? A lot of people follow it and then talk about it, right? So he's come in and deployed this particular tool in ways certainly that no president has ever done before, right? Barack Obama has a lot of followers on his Twitter account, but it doesn't generate the kind of news that follows flowing from it. So I think that's a way in which there's something unique and special to Trump. But the dominant trends, interestingly, are ones that have been slow to unfold. So the fragmentation of the media market, the rise of the digital marketplace, the introduction of social media, the echo chambers in which it isn't just that the media markets are fragmented, we self-select into them. That's not brand new, right? That was true in 2008, and Barack Obama won and won handily. And so it's not clear that just pointing to changes in the media market and the fact that Walter Cronkite, that voice of God, right, doesn't speak to all of us at the end of a hard day at work, that then we then go the next morning around the coffee, right, clatch and talk about what Walter said last night. Those days are gone, but those days have been gone for a long time. And so there's more work to be done, I think, in trying to tease out why that was so relevant for Trump, how he in particular benefited from it. Because those are long, steady trends, and Trump is not a long, steady trend. He's sort of a lightning bolt that comes in and shake things up. Maybe, right? Maybe. There are folk who want to argue that, no, he is the consummation of a set of commitments made by the Republican Party. He's not a break from the Republican Party. He is the realization of a set of commitments that they've made along the lines of economic security and race that lead to Trump, the person that we have. But I haven't heard that kind of argument made vis-a-vis the media, where I think his unique ability to make the most of it, I don't think we have a clear explanation for. He clearly benefited from, I don't know exactly how it translated, and I don't think any of us do. I mean, we don't have clear estimates.
And going forward? The media as an accountability mechanism?
Well, it depends. Do you want, right? Is it half empty or half full, right? So we know how to talk about it being half empty, right? The sense in which he wasn't called to task, one, in the election for a set of things that he said which were patently not true, and certainly not called to task in ways that resonated with the broader electorate, that the number of people who are buying, newspapers are dying all over the country, right? And people are self-selecting into these hyper-partisan venues. You're half empty, right? You're half full is that, look at the Washington Post. The Washington Post has been incredibly critical of Trump, and it's the number of people who were subscribing to the Washington Post is rebounding for the first time. And I think there's a lot of interest among certain segments of the population in making investments and deeper investments in investigative journalism. And there are ways, too, in which, he's the incoming president, but he's the incoming president by some polls that suggests his approval ratings are starting at 37%, right? And so there is a population out there that is interested in critical news coverage of this president. So, I don't know.
Excellent. So what I suggest is we take rounds of three questions and then hand it over to you. So who wants to? Right? Okay. Another question? Yep.
In the last few years of the Obama presidency, we saw a real willingness for him to use executive orders to sort of go past Congress.
Personally. There are mics going around it.
And me personally, I was a big fan of Obama, so I was sitting on the sidelines happy to, cheer him on as he was doing this. But I think now I'm wondering if you think there are going to be any lasting implications of how often we saw these used and if this is going to have sort of a lasting impact and if, liberals across America and the world are going to kind of regret it a little bit.
Okay. Question over there. Last question.
I wanted to ask about what the average citizen can do in the Trump presidency with issues like climate change, the rampant racism, misogyny that was put forth in his campaign that we've seen, the rise of hate crimes in America, and things, issues that for the next 4 years doesn't look like it's going to swing towards the side of the liberals and what we can do.
Three easy, very short answers can be given. I mean, these are huge questions. Okay, so VP, I don't know. What I will say about the VP is that it's an office that's changed over time. And the kinds of, I mean, in the 19th century, it was famously referred to as not worth, you know, a bucket of spit, right? It was, it is, but today, there, it isn't just Joe Biden, right? But also Cheney under Bush and Gore under Clinton. They all played really robust policy roles. And so the institution itself has changed over time. I think we can certainly expect that to continue with Pence. But the amount of power given to Pence is going to depend upon Trump in many ways. And that's true not just with regards to Pence. It's true with all these various cabinet appointments as well. That right now we're trying to read in to, you know, what a future president is going to look like on the basis of the appointments that he's making to his cabinet. But what we don't know, we observe the nominations. What we don't know is how much authority, how much discretion he's going to give them. I don't know it. But there's so the basic historical trend suggests Pence is a big deal. It could be an even more so. It could be less so. And that's going to, he's got discretion to decide how much so. So that's right. On executive orders, these are the politics, the partisan politics across presidential administrations of not just unilateral action, but I think of executive power more generally. So when Obama was in office, right, you were cheering because he was a fearless defender of American interests, right? And he didn't let anything get in the way of the good fight that he was waging. But when Bush was in office, doing many of the same kinds of things, you were apoplectic because you saw it as a gross abuse of constitutional authority, right? Which is precisely what Republicans did in reverse, right? Such that Republicans were pretty muted when Bush was in office, his 8 years in term, and they were apoplectic when Obama was in office. And so when I've gone around and talked about why we need a stronger presidency, it was the people who would, you know, would freak out at me most at that were people who were good conservatives, right? Because, not because, it's not about a sort of a principled basis in believing in what the proper limits of executive authority ought to be, so much as it is a belief that, and a commitment that I want people to have power provided they're going to do things that I want them to do, right? And so this is, you see this across presidential administrations again and again. It has, the fact that Obama exercises these powers has meaningful implications for the next president. The project of expanding presidential power over time, which is not just a story about Obama in his second term, it's a much longer story than that, is one that if you don't inherit the full panoply of tools and powers that were constructed by your predecessor, you at least inherit a good number of them. And so, yes, Trump benefits from the emergence of a modern presidency and a presidency that increasingly does things to work around existing statutory law and work around constitutional limitations on its powers. That's right. He's going to benefit from that. What are average citizens to do? I feel this is one where, so I'm not an expert at all on how to organize, how to effectively organize. I don't know what the answer is to that. When I go and talk about Trump, and I've been doing it for the last couple of months, when I talk about it in churches, we talk about the totality of the response that's needed, and that resistance operates on lots of levels. And so, sure, it matters a lot that one protests and writes letters to Congress, congressional representatives, saying, do this, don't do that. That for sure matters. It also, this is me, not as expert, right? This is just me as citizen saying, it also seems to me that if your concern is with nativism, that the humanities are a powerful response as well. That is, our inability to recognize our shared humanity is part of then what fuels the kind of xenophobia that is a part of Trump's campaign, that a way you check that is not just by saying, look, we can all get along in a principled sense, but by speaking to one another's humanities, and the arts do that. And so I actually think there are ways in which the enormity of the challenge, the fact that it works on so many levels that go way beyond the particular policy positions that Trump has assumed, and the challenges that they present, on the one sense, it's completely suffocating if you oppose him. On the other sense, there are ways in which it means there's space all about to offer an intentional response, but one should be intentional.
All right. Any from this side of the room? No. Oh, one from back there.
I wonder if you could just give us your opinion on the effect of polling itself as a practice on electoral outcomes, and just as a general proposition, can the practice of polling actually undermine democracy or distort?
Yes.
And thank you for your talk, by the way. Just before he becomes president and there's no looking back anymore, just with one look into the past, you mentioned all the advantages Hillary had, and obviously you have these winner-take-all states where Trump wins very tiny margins in some key states. Even with that being said, Hillary knew this. The Hillary campaign had the same objectives, to win these states. With all the advantages she has, what was it about Hillary in the face of Trump that made her such a flawed candidate for that moment?
One more? Way back over there.
If Trump stood on such an explicitly xenophobic and misogynistic platform, why do you think people voted for him, and were they wrong to do so?
Yeah. Okay. Polling, right? And its impact. I don't know how to think about whether or not polling undermines democracy. I'm just not quite sure what that means. But there's a way in which polls, I think there is reason to believe that polls might affect not just whether one shows up to vote, but how one shows up to vote. Let me suggest two, which are hardly exhaustive, but they're two. Right? One is, if you believe that it's going to be a complete blowout, right? If you believe it's a foregone conclusion that you've seen the polls in Pennsylvania that reliably show Clinton's going to win by 3 or 4 percentage points, and you're a Democrat, and damn it, I got to get the groceries on election day, right? We're good. I'm going to take a pass on that, right? So the question is not whether or not there's an effect. There surely is an effect. The question is how large that effect is. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but surely that phenomenon exists. Another way in which it works is that in the primary season, the logic of momentum. So the idea here is that if I win in an early contest, I'm more likely to win in a subsequent contest. You can think about those contests as being polls, but even the polls themselves are, I'm trying to distinguish myself on a stage of 16 people, and there's a poll that comes out that shows that I'm in the lead. Suddenly, I'm going to get more media attention, right, by virtue of being in the lead. And suddenly, a set of people who may not have known what I stand for are going to go out and learn what I stand for, just as there are a set of people who just want to back a winner. I want to be behind the winner. And they know what I do for either expressive reasons. I like backing a winner. That's one story to tell. Another story to tell is I want to get behind somebody who's likely to win in the general election. I need it to be a Republican. I don't much care which of the Republicans it is. I want to get behind a strong Republican because I want to make sure they win in the general election. So the polls may provide some information about who is strong that then is going to inform, when I show up on election day, who among the election people who are trying to get the Republican nominee I'm going to back. Which is then my way of saying, yeah, right? You can think of a bunch of ways in which polls are not just kind of these litmus tests that we drop into beakers to get a sense of, right, what the chemical composition is of a liquid, but that are actually affecting the behavior of an electorate. So why does Hillary lose? I laid out all these advantages that she has. So why does she lose? Let me suggest three. And I don't know what kind of weights to assign to them. I think we're too early for that, right? Which one is more or less important? But all three of them strike me as plausible. The first one is her approval ratings were horrible. Her disapproval ratings were north of 50%. Now, Trump's disapproval ratings were north of Clinton's disapproval ratings, and there's a paired choice that are being put before the electorate, but her disapproval ratings, I mean, you see this in the States, led to a Democratic electorate that thought, Clinton, yeah, you know, yeah, right? There was no tens of thousands of people did not descend upon Grant Park in Chicago, right, when she won the nomination. There wasn't this massive outpouring. There was this sense in which that was true from the very get-go. There's a way in which, the mistake that was made by the Democrats was picking her. I'm not saying that her disapproval ratings are justified. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting, though, is that their disapproval ratings were high going into the election, and they remained there. This was a known fact about her, and it persisted throughout the campaign. And that those people who said, well, once they get to know her, will like her more, were mistaken. Right? You didn't see those numbers budge. I think that's one thing to point to. The other one to point to is just change, right? It's hard after two consecutive terms of any one party for that same party to maintain the White House. There's an interest in change, and particularly in an era of hyper-partisanship where the Republicans are way off to the right. Yeah, off to the right, and the Democrats are way off to the left, that then it breeds a certain level of disaffection among the public, and so that leads to people wanting to bounce back and forth. That might be part of it. And the other part of it, and we haven't said this, and I'm going to take this as an opportunity to say it, because I think it's a big, again, I don't know what kind of weight to assign to this, but race has got to be a part of the story. It's not Clinton's race, but it's the role of racial appeals in that campaign, and the fact that we had our first African-American president in the office. And I don't think it's altogether coincidence that a candidate who made lots of racial appeals, right, over the course of his campaign, who started his campaign on a promise to keep, right, Mexican rapists at bay, and on and on. That those views resonated, and so again, I don't know how to put some structure on that, but race has got to be a part of this story, and to the extent that it played a role to his advantage. Were voters wrong? To your question, were they wrong to get behind him? And this is where we really get into the foundations of norms of democratic governance. What constitutes a right decision? I mean, they were not wrong insofar as we had a system for tallying votes. People on election day, there's not evidence that they claimed I meant to check A, right? I meant to check Trump, but my hand slipped, right? In that sense, they weren't wrong. We also don't have much evidence either that there are lots of people who regret their vote in the United States. Now, there may be a set of people who regretted not showing up. But I haven't seen any evidence that says people who voted for Trump wish that they hadn't, in large numbers, certainly in the kinds of numbers that you'd need to make a difference. And so to say that they're wrong, you then need to say something about, well, what their true interests are. And now we quickly get into the realm of paternalism. I'm wary to go there. I'm troubled, right? As a citizen, I'm deeply troubled. And as Barack Obama's neighbor, I live a block and a half from him. I can report to you, my community is devastated. I mean, no joke. There's this elation that happened in that community that it looked like I never saw in 2008, where people were hugging in the streets. And the image that I remember is going to, it's since shut down, but there was this newspaper stand It was all beaten up newspaper stand in Hyde Park. And I showed up there at 7 o'clock in the morning. There was a line around the block of people who all wanted to get a copy of the newspaper showing the first African-American president was elected on the South Side, and who came from the South Side of Chicago. I mean, right, it was, and what I can say is that that kind of sense of, it's much more than, validation doesn't begin to get at it, right, that was experienced then. There's this sense in which that community feels crestfallen, that how could we go from that to this in such short order? But that's me as citizen and as community member. Saying that they got it wrong, I don't know how to do it.
Right. Before we go to the next round, let me just interject just a tiny bit. So one thing that, interestingly, you brought into the equation here is the role for racism in American politics. Let me raise one other ism, and that is the role, thinking about Hillary's loss, the role of sexism in American politics. I thought about this back in 2008 with the Democratic primary, and the thing that struck me so clearly, and this is sort of absent the baggage that she acquired between 08 and 2016, so absent the email scandal, absent Benghazi et al., right, was the very clear, coming back to the press, the reporting of the rhetoric of the audience at various venues for Obama versus Hillary Clinton. And there would be a lot of reporting of sexist comments, and in a way that was made light of it. So, hey, Hillary, come iron my shirts. Those sort of things were a bit humorous, a bit side comments, sort of adding a lighthearted bit to the story. Nary a word about any kind of racial slant that was completely a taboo, where it was not a taboo to include in reporting comments about her gender. Now, it's hard to isolate that as a factor in American politics, except especially when you put it in juxtaposition to American politics. So we've seen now two women prime ministers. You have women, set aside Theresa May, but certainly Margaret Thatcher, who worked her way up through the Conservative Party, right? Did not go through the sort of electoral systems, the electoral institutions that an American president had to do in terms of facing a national audience. Very different system. Moreover, another key difference is the commander-in-chief role, which is inherently a very masculine role. For Americans to get their mind around a woman in this very masculine role, finger on the nuclear button. So the question is, to what extent do you think gender played a role?
It clearly plays a role, right? It clearly does. It's not just about, you know, mutterings about ironing my shirt. It's about sexual predation that was talked about not on the sidelines of the media. It was front and center of the conversations throughout much of October, in the month leading up to the actual election. And there is, moreover, right, there's a way in which when you break a barrier, typically what one expects is that the individual that breaks the barrier is grossly overqualified, right? It's what it takes. So there's a reason why Jackie Robinson is the first African-American baseball player in the United States. Jackie Robinson was an incredible baseball player. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Elmer Fudd who broke through. It was somebody of extraordinary stature. There's a colleague of mine who's done this paper on women in Congress, and he shows a lot of evidence that women are measured in a variety of ways, are better legislators, better than their male counterparts. And the story that he tells is that women face a level of discrimination that men don't face. And so for women to get through, they have to simply be better. And then we just had an election wherein we've already established that he was the least experienced president, but paired up against an incredibly experienced woman, right? And so when you then have talk about and evidence of and admissions to sexual predation, certainly the discussions of sexual predation as a prominent feature in the lead up to the election, and these incredible differences between men and women, how do you not say that sex and gender didn't play an important role? Again, though, it's hard to disentangle. I don't know how much of a role. A fact about the voting day? We've got Trump running, who's not obviously a Republican, and we have all kinds of scandal, right, as a daily occurrence that's being played out in the media. And yet, on election day, 90% of Republicans voted for Trump, and 90% of Democrats voted for Clinton. The electorate continued to march in formation. There's a way in which he's incredibly disruptive, but the electorate just did as they always did. If all you saw were those electoral returns, right, you'd think this is just another election where you have a standard conservative against a standard liberal, and people in their respective camps are voting the way that they are. To go to the issue then of race and gender, I don't know how important race and gender played, the role that it played in encouraging people to vote for Trump. We don't know that. We don't know that. What we do know is that the Republican Party, in overwhelming numbers, found reasons to vote for Trump even in the face of the evidence that was put before them. And so they need to think about, well, what were those other things? And how could they possibly compensate for the kinds of news stories that were breaking? But they did.
I'm just going to stand so I can see if I've missed some people on this side over here.
Yeah, question there?
Hello. You said that the media didn't focus enough on policy, particularly in the primaries, and more on just the horse race. I was wondering, what do you think Trump needs to do, if anything, to keep his electors on side, the people who voted for him?
So, question right there, and then the third question up here in the front.
Hi, I was wondering, I know we don't want to be an oracle in trying to work out what will happen with specific policies, but do you think the fact that, unlike other president-elects, he has so little in the way of policies or positions on so many different issues, in some ways is a bit of a kind of blank canvas, what that means in terms of the office and what that means in terms of the power of the cabinet and how they can shape that?
So we're going to take four questions this round. We had two people right by each other and one thought I'd... Anyway, so we're going to take four this time.
Thank you. So as we said before, we cannot really predict now what Trump is really going to do, but I mean, at least economically, there are some signs already visible. And so this whole protectionism, this economic nationalism, if you want to say so, is there actually any way that that could be successful? I mean, it isn't certainly for the neighbor states, it isn't certainly for the global trade rate, but could it be, like, at least for short term, successful for the U.S., maybe lasting for 4 years, so Trump is going to be reelected, maybe?
And in the front, thank you.
Could you say a word about your judgment regarding the divide within American society? I got the impression watching the coverage during the primaries and post-election that there's a real split between the coastal, urban, suburban America, you know, shall we say, lacrosse America, and NASCAR America, you know, the flyover states, the Rust Belt. One of the books that people were talking about throughout the primaries was J.D. Vance's Elegy for the Hillbilly. And yet, every time he was on American TV, he was surrounded by people who were congratulating him, but they're all from the New York Times, Washington Post, all the elite. And I would surmise that a lot of the people who voted for Trump had a visceral and vitriolic dislike, hatred for Hillary because of what she represented. She represented that elite.
Yeah, there was a way in which Trump is obviously anti-establishment, right? He's reacting. Anything that has a, you know, smells of expert, he's going to impugn. He's going to denigrate, and to great applause from his fan base, right? And yet, we come to election day again, and Republicans vote Republicans, Democrats vote Democrats. This is not a deep cross-cutting issue. This is not 1932, in which electorally the coalition supporting the Democratic Party changed dramatically. People who had never voted Democrat suddenly started voting Democrat, right? That's not what we just observed. Which is why, to my mind, the discussion about this urban-rural divide, it's not that it's wrong, but it's overemphasized. And this guy sold too many books. He shouldn't be selling all these books. He doesn't have, right? Yes, there is a group of rural voters that's disenfranchised and that is angry and that they came out and they supported Trump. That for sure is true. But there's a way in which the fact that Trump won by a handful of votes in these three states, you can make the claim that any number of things made the difference. That made a difference, sure. James Comey coming out, making this announcement about the emails that were on Anthony Weiner's email account, right? Right? That matters too, right? As does what's going on in the media, as does the fact that Hillary Clinton in the general election never goes to Wisconsin. Exactly, right? So there are a whole host of things that maybe that would make a difference, and they may well have. But to my mind, the enormity of this election invites us to ask more foundational questions that have less to do with kind of how might we have redirected the outcome, but try to make sense of our polity, because there is something profound going on in play. I'm going to do these in reverse order. Economic nationalism, right? Can he do it? Can he be successful? Let's bracket whether or not the kinds of policies that he wants to advance are good or bad. Right? Let's just be silent about that for the moment, right? And say, well, can he actually advance them? And the answer is yes, right? There's an open question how far, but right, the TPP is dead. Now, chances are it would have been dead had it been Hillary. Because of her primary challenge, she distanced herself from it, but it is positively dead under Trump. And presidents have a fast-track authority in trade policy, which allows them to set the agenda on trade policies in ways that they can't on domestic policy, that is going to play to his advantage. Just as he can exercise these unilateral powers that we talked about earlier that are available to him. He can do things. Now, he may do things that engender a political backlash of one form or another that then may lead to enough Republicans saying, no more with you. Your approval ratings went from 37% to 4%, and we're no longer going to stand with you because you're advancing this economic nationalism, which is not consistent with much of conservative thinking. And so we want to recover what that is. But sure, this is hugely consequential in terms of a policy outcome. He has powers to wield in this domain. The fact that he lacks clear positions on a host of issues, does that then mean, I think there's a thought, and with some rationale, that that's going to mean he's going to depend more on his advisors in order to advance a particular policy agenda. That could be a couple things that we ought to know. Some ways he lacks an agenda. In other ways, he's incredibly clear about what he wants to do. Right? He wants to build a wall, goddammit, right? There's a thing. And so I'm interested to see how you're going to do that now. You've made this very clear promise. What is it going to be, a virtual wall? Right? Is it going to be like a partial wall? And that we're going to back away from a host of trade agreements with other countries. He's going to do those things. He also, in selecting his advisors, all presidents, they care about expertise. They also care about loyalty. And he really cares about loyalty. And so the ways in which his cabinet is going to provide an alternate view and are going to capture the Trump presidency and set it on the right course, I'm skeptical of that. But he may rely to a greater extent on, in domains in which he doesn't have a view, on the advice that he's given. I think we'll see. I think there's certainly reason to believe that Pence is going to play a particularly important role in this administration for precisely that reason. if I understood the first question right, it had to do with what can Trump do to keep electors on his side? Do you have mind from the Electoral College? So that vote has already gone through, so he's now incoming president. So that he doesn't need to worry about. Right? That's happened. That date passed. But there's a more general version of your question, which is, all right, how does he keep his sort of core supporters in play? Right? How is he going to do that? And my guess is as good as yours. My sense is there's going to be a lot of direct communication with Twitter. There's going to be a lot of that. There's going to be a lot of pandering that's going to be about. So, for instance, when he issues the tweet 3 days after being elected about how people who burn the flag, there ought to be a constitutional amendment against flag burning, and people who burn it maybe ought to lose their citizenship. Right? He sends out a tweet because that's a live issue. It's not a live. Nobody's been talking about this as an issue, and here comes the tweet. The only way it seems to me to understand that is him throwing red meat to his base, right? And so there's going to be some effort on his part, I think, to right, provide some symbolic representation of their concerns and their views. But there are also big challenges, right? Because Congress is independently elected, right? These are people who are not beholden to him, per se. They're not. Now, many of them are fearful because they don't want to be subject to his wrath for electoral reasons, but they also are independently elected. They were not appointed by him. And there are ways in which Congress can push back, and that's what I'm going to be watching for. If you want to look for a turn, the place to look is not does right the temperature of Democrats right go from here to here, right? That's not. It's whether or not a number of moderate Republicans start breaking from him. And the first place where I think we may see this is on Russia. But that's my read of it. I also was among the many people who was convinced that he was going to lose. I was sure of it, right? And there we are. So
I think we have time for one more round, and I'll kind of focus. I don't want to be ignoring this side of the room. So one, two, three.
Hello. You said that the media portrayed Mr. Trump as like a lightning bolt who might come and go, and you also said that he could be a culmination of what the Republican Party has set up. But do you also feel at all that he could be the beginning of a completely different kind of politician, and that more might come after him who are just like him?
Thanks very much for your talk. You spoke about how the checks and balances of the Founding Fathers might not restrain and discipline this man. And of course, the checks and balances of the Founding Fathers have always stood to some degree in tension with a core underlying part of the narrative of democracy, the idea of we the people, the rule of the people. And my question to you is, what would be the best way that civil society, as it's mobilizing now, can leverage the legitimacy that they're going to gain from being able to claim the popular vote? So we have the checks and balances maybe failing, but we have the core of democracy of we the people maybe coming into the fore. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One more.
If I may, I'd like to put you a question I was asked myself this afternoon by one of my high school students. Would you agree with John Lewis in describing Trump's election win as illegitimate?
It's illegitimate. Ah, so we're going to go out with a bang, aren't we? They're connected. These three are connected. New kind of politician? I don't know. I think he is playing into a set of sensibilities that have a long intellectual political history. These populist appeals, the rhetoric that he's employing, kind of base racial appeals that he's offering, the sense in which there's an expert class that doesn't have you in mind. This kind of talk is not new. It's not new. What is new, it seems to me, is, again, it's being articulated by somebody with so little experience and who is so intemperate, who is so, how to put this, right, volatile, You don't know. And it's part of the excitement of him, right? It's part of his strength. But he distinguishes himself on those dimensions, but it's hard for me to see how on those dimensions that's the basis for the emergence of an altogether new type of politician. I'm skeptical. We, the people, we have institutional checks, and yet there is the we, the people, that is for sure true, and these are linked insofar as he runs as a scion of the people, right? He's running a populist campaign against the Washington, D.C. insiders who have done nothing for you. This is what he tells African Americans around the country. This party that you keep voting for has done nothing for you. Try me out, right? He's going to be the voice of the people, and it's terribly inconvenient for him that he does not get the popular vote, just in terms of his ability not just to make a claim to a mandate, which is problematic for any president to make a claim to, but in order to leverage the argument that the people, the great unwashed, in fact, want to see dramatic change, and they want to see it in him. When he fails to get the popular vote, and when his approval ratings are low as they are, and when much of his own party offers the tepid support, and when there are lots of opportunities for average citizens to push back. And going back to your question, like, how do they? That's best asked to somebody other than me. But I think that I think we can expect on the left to see a level of resistance we haven't seen before, and a recovery of their voice. There are ways in which the Clintons, if we want to sort of name names, and third-way politics were really disruptive to the capacity of people on the left to articulate, here are the principles that we stand for. It was much of it is, we were getting hammered for years and years on the left for being weak on crime. I'm going to introduce a crime bill. Right? We've been hammered on being anti-free trade. I'm going to introduce NAFTA. That's what Clinton does. And he appropriates some of the positions on the right, and certainly appropriates their rhetoric as well, in the service of short-term political expedience. And one might say that had implications for the capacity of Hillary Clinton to articulate an overriding vision, lots of policy positions, lots of expertise. But what was her message? Right? Now, she was trying to tell this message in a context where the media is incredibly fragmented, in which there's a scandal a day, and it's hard to train your attention on one governing kind of principle. It's objectively difficult to do that. But the need is great, and that maybe one of the things that will happen, if you're looking for a silver lining and you're on the left, is the recovery of voice. But that's something to be found not in the short term, but in the intermediate term. Because in the short term, Republicans are ascendant in state and in the federal government, and they've got powers to exercise. Which then goes to illegitimate, wow. In the same way, did they make a mistake? Did voters make a mistake? I don't know quite how to pin that down. How do you say it was illegitimate? I mean, some things that would be clear evidence of it being illegitimate is you'd say there were people who voted in ways that they made lots of mistakes or lots of voter suppression. Now, that's clear evidence. It's now, if we go a little bit further, is the rise of fake news and the extent to which people were casting votes not on the basis of considered opinion, certainly not considered opinion, but false opinions, like objectively false opinions. Does that then mean that the outcomes of an electorate are illegitimate in some moral sense? It's certainly not in some legal sense, in some moral sense. I'm wary of it. I'm going to say, there were votes that were cast. They were cast freely. We have a media that's constituted as it is, given an existing set of rules that are problematic, but there they are, right? That set up a contest between two candidates. But I can see now you are frowning. A number of you are frowning. Like, yeah, not good enough. And I get that too. And so I guess where I want to throw it back to your students is to say, give me a clear definition of what you mean by legitimacy. What does it mean to say that an election is legitimate? There are lots of reasons to be troubled for sure, about the roles that race and class and sex and sexism played in this election, the level of disinformation and the outcome that a lot of people fear. There's lots of reasons to worry deeply. Does that translate into illegitimate? I don't know. But let's stop there. There's so much to talk about in this stuff. Thanks for spending an hour and a half with me.
So before we wrap up, let me just express heartfelt thanks to Will. It's rare when you see a speaker not only give an impassioned, you know, intellectually stimulating talk, but also be able to respond to a plethora of different kinds of questions, make linkages between them, not spend half an hour answering one question, but moving on. So for that, you've made my role as chair very easy, but I hope that the audience will take this opportunity to thank you. If I give you a heart.